And hello, everyone. Welcome to this week's weekly Yap podcast, the Yes And podcast. I'm your host, Travis Thomas, the creator of Live Yes And. And Live Yes And is dedicated to helping individuals, teams, and companies discover their inner brilliance through a commitment to purpose, authenticity, and life-transforming collaboration. So you can look me up at liveyesand.com, follow me on social media at Live Yes And. And for those of you who haven't listened in a few weeks, I am now doing a daily broadcast every morning, usually around 9 a.m. Eastern time on Periscope. So if you follow me on Twitter or look me up, Live Yes And, I do a daily Periscope where I share an idea or a concept of what it means to live yes and hopefully give you a little bit of inspiration to carry into your day. And if you're not familiar with Periscope, Periscope is an interactive broadcasting tool where you can watch live broadcasts as well as give feedback, ask questions, and things like that via text chat. So would love to have you connect with me that way. And it's always great to hear from new people. So this week's podcast, episode 22, the Double Deuce, I am so excited about, and I'm going to waste as little time as possible getting into this podcast. So just a couple of reminders real quick. Thank you to everyone for coming out and supporting the Jove Comedy this past weekend. We were at the New Kelsey Theater in North Palm Beach in Lake Park and had a wonderful, wonderful turnout, a great audience. We were the first official show at the newly opened Kelsey Theater, and we're looking forward to that being a regular venue for us each month. And so thank you to everyone coming out. For those of you in Boca, we're coming to Boca in about a week and a half. And so you can always follow us at the Jove Improv as well as the Jove Comedy Experience on Facebook as well. So we'd love to have you guys come out. And lastly, coming up March 7th, I am facilitating and starting another 30 Days of Yes 101 program. That is a 30-day program. You get 30 different activities over 30 days emailed directly to you. You do the activity. I am there as a facilitator, as a supporter, and it's all about helping you live with more purpose and authenticity. So that is a $60 program. It starts on Monday, March 7th. You can go to my website, Live Yes And, under programs, and you will get more information on that. So let's get into it. Our guest today, I've met Captain Chaby a few times while I was at IMG Academy. I met him a few times, and then he spoke at the TEDx event at IMG Academy that I was a co-host for. And then most recently, we both spoke and delivered over in Dunedin, Florida, where the Toronto Blue Jays headquarters is for spring training. And we both spoke at a symposium there for their strength and conditioning coaches. We reconnected, and we're really excited about potentially doing some speaking in the future together. But he was nice enough to take time away on Friday to just talk a little bit about mindset, about his specific experience being a Navy SEAL for 27 years. He's a captain now, but a 27-year veteran of the Navy SEAL program. And so it was such a treat to have him on, talk about his experience, how he got through it, just kind of what that Navy SEAL mentality is, and then sort of how he is using it in his life today and how he's trying to help veterans and other service people, especially once they leave serving. So we're going to get into all of that in the podcast today. I'm not going to waste any time. And if you notice the music that we played, that I played to kick it off, you might recognize that from Top Gun. And the funny thing is, I was like, oh, what music am I going to play for the intro? That's the music that I thought of. But then I thought, you know what, that might be offensive to him. I don't want to assume. And then you will hear he actually references Top Gun during our interview. So, Captain Chaby, that intro music was for you. So without further ado, let's get into our weekly Yap interview for this week. I'm so grateful. Thanks so much. It is Captain Tom Chaby. Enjoy.
And hello, welcome to this week's weekly Yap, the Yes And podcast. And so excited for my guest today. We were supposed to talk about a week ago, but because of schedules and things like that, we had to bump it, which I'm totally fine with because this is an even more perfect timing. So on the phone with me, I have Captain Tom Chaby. Tom, thanks so much for taking the time. I know we're both in Florida. We're not very close in Florida, but thanks so much for taking the time this morning to chat.
Absolutely, Trent. Thanks for the opportunity.
Yes, and now, so Tom and I have had an opportunity to meet each other a few times, once at IMG Academy, or actually probably twice at IMG Academy, and then most recently at the Toronto Blue Jays Strength and Conditioning Symposium, where we both got a chance to deliver. I unfortunately didn't get to see your delivery the night before, but was super grateful that you were able to stick around the next day. But every time I've spoken with you, Tom, I've thoroughly enjoyed not only sort of your passion and your authenticity for your work and your career, but just sort of the lessons learned that you share with the audiences. And so so thanks again. I'm just really curious to find out. I guess my first question would be, Tom, what was your main motivation for wanting to become? I mean, a Navy SEAL. We're talking, you know, that's top level stuff. So what was it for you that inspired you to want to become a SEAL?
Well, Travis, for me, it really started in my childhood when I found that first place where I really felt like I connected and I belonged, and that was in athletics. I started playing football, I ran track, and I competed in snow skiing competitively. I was a mogul skier. I grew up in the Northeast, okay. And my life revolved around sports. It got me out of trouble. It brought me a lot of pride, accolades. But the thing it really gave me was a relevant position in the world. And being a teammate is one of the greatest feelings I ever had. And flash forward after my high school and then my unceremonious collegiate career, I got injured, hurt my knee, and the athletic opportunities closed in on me, and I really didn't have the physical capability to continue at that point. A couple years flashed by, and I really was spiraling downward, looking for the answers to life. What am I going to do? I was young still. I had no idea what I wanted to do business-wise, and I had seen the movie. I'm almost embarrassed to admit this, but I had seen the movie years before, Top Gun, and I was really struck by the camaraderie in that movie. And a friend of mine and I started talking, and I was building my knee back up, and although I wouldn't be able to play football again, you know, I could start running, and things were coming back. And I decided to go see a recruiter, and I was there, went through the whole process over about a month. And I was essentially on my way to go through the aviator pipeline to hopefully become the next Maverick or Iceman. And right before I signed the dotted line, I was speaking with my recruiter, and I remember her name, Susan Zahodny, and this was in Seattle, Washington, where I was living at the time. I saw a photo on her desk, and I asked her, who is that? And it was somebody very important to her in her life, and she told me that he was a Navy SEAL. And I was, like, blown away because I had never even heard of what that was. And you got to keep in mind, this was back in 1988, before the movie Navy SEALs came out, before Demi Moore, before all the crazy books and et cetera, that are out there branding us like they are today. And she said, hey, why don't you watch this video? And it was called Be Someone Special, and it was a recruiting video for the Navy. And I watched it, and I asked if I could take it home with me that night. And this is all pre-DVD, mind you. And I found myself enthralled with everything about this community, just the camaraderie, the mission, the sacrifice. And it really just sucked me in. I watched it probably five or six times that night, came in the next morning and spoke with the recruiter. And I said, hey, look, I want to do this. What do I need to do? And she said, well, let me find out. And she got to work for me. And I was very fortunate that she was the recruiter that I went to see initially, because she had the connections and she was able to find all the various nuances of what I would need to do to get in the community. And she helped me out. And a few months later, I found myself being shipped off to Newport, Rhode Island with a shaved head. And my SEAL career began at that point in the summer of 1989.
Wow, wow. So it sounds like it was really that idea, sort of from camaraderie and belonging. It sounds like that was the link for you in sports, and it sounds like that was maybe that initial connection or the inspiration that you saw with the SEALs.
Absolutely. You know, I'll just break it down to one word for you: connectedness. I didn't have that when I was starting my career as a mortgage broker in the metro New York City area where I grew up. And it was just something that defined me in my young adulthood, and I really missed it. And I was happy to be going in a direction to hopefully get it back.
Excellent. Wow. And I, you know what, and I love, Tom, that you wasted no time connecting the dots between you, Tom Cruise, Charlie Sheen, and Demi Moore within the first 5 minutes of the podcast. So thank you for doing
that. Well, absolutely. I am quite Hollywood. I'm absolutely the anti-Hollywood. I am nothing to do with that. But yes, thank you for noting that.
No, I appreciate that 80s reference for me, if not for anyone else. All right, so Tom, so take us right into SEAL training, and now it's called BUDS training. Is that correct?
That is correct. And BUDS is an acronym, and it stands for Basic Underwater Demolition SEAL Training. And what that essentially means is the demolition pieces stems from our ancestors and our family tree, the SEAL family tree, where we really came from underwater demolition teams. And back in the early 60s, President John F. Kennedy, being a good Navy man, when the Bay of Pigs fiasco came down, he realized he needed to have a naval special operations capability, and there really wasn't that at that time. And he commissioned the first SEAL team, SEAL Team 1 and SEAL Team 2. So basic underwater demolition training became the BUDS, became the pipeline to get from being a Navy sailor or being a civilian to becoming a SEAL. 26-week course, and it's grueling. There's a piece of it called Hell Week, which is 5.5 days. And during those 5.5 days, you get 4 hours sleep. That's not 4 hours per night. That's 4 hours total sleep over 5.5 days. And the remainder of the 26 weeks is brutal. It's focused. It's demanding. And it really is fast-paced. You better keep up or you're going to go away. Only 25% of the candidates make it through the pipeline. And I'm quite proud to say I survived.
So you find yourself in the midst of this program, 26 weeks, let alone Hell Week. I can't imagine that, Tom, that anyone, even though we obviously the public knows a lot more about sort of that process now, at least from a, you know, with the internet, with movies and TV shows. But for yourself, you find yourself in the midst of this training. What was it for you that got you through it? What was it for you that you were able to, you know, to lean on that sort of got you through that experience?
Fantastic question, Travis. I during 2 points in my 26-year naval career, I was assigned to the Naval Special Warfare Center, and that's where we run this training, basic underwater demolition SEAL training. And while you're an instructor or a leader in the pipeline, you just can't help but reflect and try to define what makes one successful to get through the training. Because there's extreme pressure from big Navy, from Congress, for us to, hey, 75% attrition is not a good thing. We need to figure out either selecting better people, better preparing them, or finding the secret sauce to help more people get through, because it's expensive. It costs over $1 million to create a Navy SEAL. And for me, doing all that reflective thinking and all that analysis of the various training classes, it came down to one word again. It was perspective. Here I was before I came into the SEAL community. I just desperately wanted to be connected again. I just needed to be part of a team. And I had just recently been in the mortgage brokerage industry, and nothing against that industry. It just wasn't the right thing for me at that time. I knew if I didn't make it through this training, if I quit or I failed, that's about all I had. And I love, I'm going to quote another 80s movie for you. I had no place else to go. Do you know which movie that was from?
No, I don't know that one.
Officer and a Gentleman, the highly esteemed Richard Gere.
All right, we've got Richard Gere in the mix now. Okay, all right, well done, well played. Talk about perspective a little bit more. Was it the idea, so again, essentially not having a plan B, was there just that sense for you that I either pass this or there is no other option?
Absolutely. You know, seeing dozens and dozens of SEAL FUDS classes go through Hell Week and seeing the array of students, and you, it's unbelievable. We have gold medal recipients. We have people who play pro football, pro baseball, that are national champions in this, that were Rhodes Scholars, that were Harvard League captains of their sports teams. And when you're sitting in the cold, 53 to 55 degree Pacific Ocean for 20, 30 minutes for multiple repetitions of this, it really breaks things down to, are you motivated to be there? You really want to be miserable because it's misery.
Yeah.
Buds and help especially is miserable. Do you really want this? Because if you have other opportunities, if you could go home and take over your dad's business, or if you have a full scholarship to go to MIT because you did so well in undergraduate waiting for you, I'll tell you what, if I had any of those things, it would have been tough for me to sit in that cold water. It would have been tough for me to continue running with that heavy boat on my head, grinding away on my neck and spine. So yeah, perspective for me was everything. And I think it's also the enemy of those people that have tons of opportunities. You know,
yeah.
We like to call it fire in the gut. You know, I'm going to throw another, I don't think this is 80s, but it's another old movie, Rudy. And
yeah.
You think of that kid, at least the way he was portrayed in the movie. You know what? He wasn't going to stop until he got what he was after. And that's the kind of guy we're looking for. Because you know what? We can't wait to find out if they have the motivation and the perseverance and the resilience, physical, psychological, emotional, and social resilience to succeed in the mountains of Afghanistan, for example. We can't wait till we're there to find that out. We have to know before we put that individual in those conditions.
And so when you talk about sort of this idea of, you know, really trying to find that special sauce to help with the attrition rate, is it more sort of understanding what their motivation is coming into the program?
Indeed, the beginning part of the training is designed for exactly that. You know, like, why would we put somebody through 5.5 days of hell with only 4 hours total sleep? Why would we do that? You're certainly not going to build anybody up. But what it does do is it reveals the character of the candidate. It reveals the level of resilience of the candidate. It reveals, what is this person made of? Do they have what it takes to be part of our brotherhood?
And so Tom, take us into your experience. And so you're in the water. It's freezing. You're in the water. And can you remember for yourself what was going through your head and how you were able to just, I guess, for lack of a better phrase, deal with the moment? You know, you're in it. It's miserable. So what are you? What's the self-talk that you were having with yourself to allow you to respond to that situation?
I found myself reflecting on my personal situation. I found myself considering, what were the consequences if I quit? It's easy to quit. The whole program's designed to have a red carpet right up to the bell, and that's how you disenroll from our training, is you walk up to a bell and you ring it three times. That's the demarcation line in the sand that you're no longer part of the program. It's not meant to disrespect the student. It's just meant to clearly illustrate your intent. So for me, I found myself, if I do that, this option of the ultimate connectedness will be lost forever. So it was a non-option for me. I could not go. Believe me, I wanted no part of sitting in the ocean. Sure, I would have loved a hot cup of cocoa on day three of Hell Week, and I sure would have loved to go to sleep for 15, 14 hours. But you know what? For me, it was a non-option because I wanted that connectedness so badly that was a small price to pay to get to where I wanted to end up.
Yeah, yeah. Now, talk a little bit, maybe you personally, or just the SEAL program in general. How is it that you guys actually address the idea of fear? You know, is it something? You know, is it something that's talked about? Is it something that you prepare for? But or individually, when there is a fear, is there a process for actually dealing with the fear?
You know, when I came into the training pipeline, fear was basically an entity that was dealt with through the perception of you either can handle it or you can't. And they would just continually throw you into situations that would make most men shudder. Can you handle this? And your mm-hmm. ability to handle fear would be revealed. And it was purely, mm-hmm. in a lot of cases, luck. Did you have the skills to navigate fear? And I was lucky in the beginning of my career because I did in a lot of respects. Having been a mogul skier, I found myself doing a lot of extreme skiing. So the physical fear piece was something that I had learned to deal with. The psychological piece of having played football and having guys much, much larger and stronger than I was trying to crush me on a routine basis allowed me to develop the psychological mechanisms to handle fear. And then the emotional ones, I think I just was blessed with just through my life experience. But what we're doing now is we're leveraging performance psychology. We're going out there and we're working with the brightest in the industry. And this is a new growing field where you can actually do deliberate things to help handle fear. And in my opinion, I nug fear down to one thing. It's how you perceive the situation. If you perceive something as threatening, you're probably going to be fearful. But if you can take that same situation and recharacterize it and perceive it as challenging, you're not going to be as fearful and you're going to be empowered. And what scientists and physiologists and psychophysiologists are learning is this mere perception shift creates an entirely different set of physiology in the individual. So back to those original two perceptions, if you perceive something as a threat, your physiology will get very disempowering. Your breathing will get much more shallow. Your vision will get myopic. You're not going to be as creative. And study after study proves this. While if you look at something as a challenge, and mind you, for you to look at something as a challenge, you have to acknowledge that you have the tools to succeed in this situation. So when you look at it as a challenge that you can succeed with, wow, you start broadening your vision, opening up your breathing. And in the first case, when it's a threat, your body is pumping out cortisol, which initially can be an okay thing, but in the long term, it's very negative. While when you look at something as a challenge, you start pumping out much, much, much more empowering substances, testosterone at higher levels, where now you are empowered to do great things. You know, a great example of this is look at the end of a football game. One team's up by 21 points. The other team is down. There's no way they can come back. The other team can barely pick themselves up off the ground. The team that's winning is jumping up and down on the sideline with the energy of a team that can play an entire another game.
Right.
Now, do we really think that these two teams have that much of a difference in physical conditioning? I would argue absolutely not. It's a matter of how they've empowered or disempowered their own physiology. And there's a great book out called Top Dog, written by Ashley Merriman and Poe Bronson, and it breaks this down into just simple, easy to digest and understand narrative. And for me, when I was done reading that book, I threw it across the room because I was so disappointed that I had not had those tools earlier in my athletic career. So we're bringing things like that into the equation. So rather than relying on random luck, we're trying to deliberately prepare people for fear because you know what? It's science. And if you bring the right things to the equation, you can dominate.
Yes. Yeah. And I do highly recommend the book as well. It really is fantastic. Whether someone's looking at it from an athletic standpoint or a corporate standpoint, even just a life standpoint, it really is a great read for everybody. Now, When I envision the training time, I always envision that this idea of trying to get the SEAL so far out of their comfort zone that basically there is no such thing as being outside of their comfort zone. Would that be pretty accurate?
Yeah, I would take it even a step further. We don't want to just be placed out of our comfort zone. We actually thrive and seek conditions that are outside our comfort zone. But we make what's uncomfortable for most people comfortable for us. And that is one of our huge advantages. You know, we'll look at when are we going to go on a key operation? We're going to wait till the moon is down, the weather is the worst, and most people would not want to be outside, let alone conducting a sophisticated operation. So we're going to desperately seek the worst conditions. In fact, we've been trained to such a level that I almost have to manufacture these conditions and manufacture stress to get myself to function at the level where I'm really humming and doing my best work.
Interesting. Well, I, and from my standpoint, again, and I have to admit, when we were speaking at the Toronto Symposium, I was a little self-conscious because I'm delivering, I'm talking about yes and, I'm talking about improvisation, and there's a Navy SEAL in the back of the room, you, and I'm sitting there going, oh, good Lord, what am I saying, and what does he think about what I'm saying as far as having this yes and mindset as far as how we respond to adversity and how we respond to challenges from an improviser standpoint. And when I think of Navy SEALs, I think of here is this highly trained group of individuals that they basically approach every obstacle from this clear sense of really yes and. It's you not being able to control the situation, not being able to control what's happening, but being able to respond with clarity and effectiveness and a sense of purpose. And so for you, how is that trained and how is that continually developed?
You know, it's an evolution. You know, I speak like I was the master of handling pressure and the master of working in some of the most unrelenting conditions from day one. But, you know, I think there's a hierarchy or evolution of buy-in and growth where you're exposed to it and on the surface it makes sense. But then when you start applying it and then you start seeing it thriving under the most challenging conditions, you realize, wow, this really is effective. So for me, it was just the pure example after example after example of being empowered through this new mindset that's foreign to most people, and how effective it is when you need to be working at your highest level and most people actually fall to their lowest. So for me, that was the answer, to just really trust, grow. And I really, you know, sitting in the back of the room at the Toronto Blue Jays symposium, I loved what you were doing. And for me, we never deliberately get into improv in the SEAL community, but I truly believe the best units do exactly what you do, where they build off of each other. And we have a great principle of leadership, which we refer to as team ability, where most people look at a military unit and they think there's somebody at the top of the organization and then all the way down to the lowest person on the totem pole. What we've done in our community is we've tipped it over sideways, and we've mandated that every single member of our team be a leader. And then the senior leaders empower the junior personnel to own the situation and bring their value into it. So when one of my young teammates says, "Excuse me, I got an idea," we want to hear it. We want to empower them, because you never know where the best idea is going to come from.
Oh, that's fantastic. Yeah, and how empowering it is for that. For that person, when they see that their ideas are valued and want to be heard.
Absolutely. You know, for me, my favorite word is relevance. And as a leader, you're almost the holder of relevance, and you have a choice to empower your team and make them relevant, or to micromanage and not give them any relevance at all. Obviously, the first example is what you want to do, to give as much relevance and spread it around so your entire team's empowered to effectiveness. For me, the more relevant I can make other people and the less relevant I become, I have learned the exact opposite happens. When I give away my relevance, I don't become less relevant. I become more relevant at the end of the day, and our team functions at the highest level.
Oh, I love it. I love that. Yeah, I love that selflessness. That's beautiful. when you look back on your career, what surprises you most? What have you, as far as what you've learned?
Well, that's a great question. I think human nature in general, you know, through my early adulthood and my time as an athlete, you know, I think we're caught in a lot of paradigms as leaders organizationally, where there are all these assumptions about what should happen in a team environment. And what surprises me most is so many of them are flawed. I mean, I understand where they come from, but when you live life from a perspective like you are, with your effort, Live Yes and from my efforts, where we need to empower everybody because we don't know where the solution is going to come from, we don't know who is going to be the hero of the day, you really see what's in the realm of the possible. And I think so many organizations, and I have the privilege to work with organizations now, sports teams, professional, collegiate, and corporations out in the industry, and I'm blown away by how few of them truly empower their people. They sure say and talk a big game about doing it, but when you really break it down, they don't do it at all, and it could be so much more effective if they would look for creating the culture and a system that would truly empower their people. But with empowerment, you have to also have a complementary parallel system of accountability. Because if you empower people and they misuse empowerment, then it defeats the purpose. So creating a culture where there's a balance between those two, the empowerment and the accountability, then you really see true growth and the true potential of your organization could be tapped into.
And speaking of empowerment, Tom, I want to transition a little bit because I know we're almost out of time here, but I would love for you to share sort of where your focus and where your work is right now. I know you're spending a lot of time helping veterans. And so can you share a little bit about the work that you're doing now and how you're trying to help empower and help the veterans?
Yeah, thanks so much for that question. My last assignment, I was selected by Admiral McCraven, who is one of the finest leaders I've had the opportunity to work for, to come to Tampa and lead an effort called Preservation of the Forced and Family, POTFF, P-O-T-F-F. And the effort is built around creating a system that advocates and provides resources for the service member, the special operator, and his family, centered around resilience, building resilience, sustaining resilience, and looking at how are we employing these special operators? Are we burning them out? Are we setting them up for failure? In a lot of cases, the way we used to look at the war we're in right now, we truly were. We looked at sleep, for example, like another great movie, and it's lost on me right now, the actor, but I'll think of it in a second. It's from the great movie Roadhouse, I'll Get Enough Sleep When I Die. And horrible,
Patrick Swayze.
Horrible. Patrick Swayze. It wasn't him that said it, though. It was Sam Elliott who said it. There we go.
Oh, Sam Elliott. Yes.
And in the movie, they refer to sleep in this John Wayne-esque sort of way, and that's the way we looked at it. But when you look at sleep deprivation, for example, my last deployment, I kept a log, and over a seven-month period, I slept 2 hours and 53 minutes a night on average over that 7 months. And horrible. Most of it was because I was inefficient and I couldn't keep up with the work, but some of it was the demands of the battlefield. I was in Iraq. And that is an unbelievably horrible place to put yourself as a leader, as an operator, or as a teammate. And I was undoubtedly in a negative cortisol spiral where who knows what could have happened. You know, sadly, part of POTFF, I was assigned to take a hard look at suicide and suicide prevention. And when we start doing the forensics of the suicides, which we've had our share of, unfortunately, sleep deprivation is a piece of it.
Yeah.
The demands of the battlefield are another piece of it. But more importantly, how people perceive the battlefield. And it goes back to that challenge and threat that I was talking about earlier. Why can two people go through the same deployment and one of them suicidal at the end and the other's thriving and he's empowered? Some of it is how they grew up and their makeup and their physical readiness, et cetera. But another piece of it is how they perceive the conditions they were living under. If they perceived that day after day after day as a threatening situation, they were building up cortisol to such a point they were going to be in a state where they could do something they never could do before. And the examples I use here are, we know guys that took steroids in high school and college, at least I do, and they were different people because their hormonal balance was out of whack. It changed their personality drastically. But you do this same cortisol spin with people, it can change their personality. It could change how they perceive reality. And I believe, and a lot of noted experts from great institutions to include Harvard, Stanford, Palo Alto University agree with me that this downward cortisol spiral is the condition setter for somebody to do something negative to their own life. Now, my last assignment was to try to create a system to help prevent this, to reduce the suicide, which is happening, thank goodness, to reduce the alcohol dependency and drug dependency, which was reducing, thank goodness, to reduce divorce and the other negative behavior choices, and really empower these people to a state of wellness. When you look at the medical system of the United States, and the military medical system mirrors that in most cases, it is 100% a tertiary system where we respond to problems. POTF was designed to prevent problems. Let's get ahead of these challenges so we can empower people to be well, and it's about wellness. And that's the future, and our country is rapidly moving in that direction. There's a lot of exciting things happening out there for service members, for veterans, and for the civilian sector as well. I really look forward to 10 or 20 years from now where we're going to have a completely different system, complete with reduction or elimination of the stigma of seeking behavioral health care, complete with just the idea of changing your diet can change everything about your life, something I did not acknowledge until recently. So there's a lot of exciting things on the horizon. I was so fortunate to be a small part of it. I continue to advocate for my teammates, the veterans and service members. I continue to do anything I can to help and connect the dots to get this system moving in the right direction.
Well, and I love too, Tom, how it kind of comes full circle when I think about the work that you're doing now, and I know that there's so many great servicemen and veteran organizations out there that that are really trying to help with a lot of these issues that you referred to. And you started off talking about your attraction to athletics and your attraction to, you know, service in the first place was this idea of connectedness and belonging. And it just feels like now you are sort of, you're working on that missing piece, which is, you know, where does that belonging and connectedness come from when your service time is over? And I imagine the void that is felt when that time comes, and now being able to address a lot of those problems.
Yes, you know, as I'm transitioning out of the military, I'm looking for one thing. I want to be relevant, and that's my goal in life. And for me, if I'm relevant, I'm happy, and I can do great work.
Well, you absolutely are, and it's funny, Tom. I rarely take a lot of notes during sessions because I just like listening. But I caught myself taking a lot of notes during while you were speaking today, and I blocked off a bunch of these that kind of feel like a map. And the words that really popped, the words that I think you really spoke about was connectedness, belonging, perspective, team ability, relevance, and empowerment. And I think once you write that book, I think we have all of your chapters fleshed out already.
Fantastic. But sorry to disappoint you. I think there's enough SEAL books out on the market already.
There's always room for yours, man. There's always room for yours.
There we go.
Well, Captain Chabie, hey, I'm so appreciative and respectful of your time. I could go on for hours just kind of picking your brain and hearing about the process and your work and everything that you've done. But so grateful on my end, and thanks so much for taking the time. Is there anywhere that you would want people to go as far as to be in touch with you or to make a connection with you?
Absolutely. My email address is tomchabie31, so T-O-M, C as in Charlie, Hotel Alpha Bravo Yankee, the number 1, at gmail.com. And I just want to give a shout-out to your listeners. Thank you for the extreme benevolence of our country. I feel like we, this current generation of warriors, is riding on the shoulders of the Vietnam vets that were so mistreated for years. I feel our generation feels a sense of shame almost, and they want to make up for it. And we have truly benefited from your benevolence. And I'm not referring only to financial benevolence. I'm referring to people just reaching their hand out and extending it and saying, thanks for what you do. I frankly could not wear my uniform out in town and walking to Starbucks because I could never pay for my coffee. Not that I'm looking for that, but it's just such a great thing. And I encourage you, when you see a young soldier, sailor, airman, marine, or Coast Guardsman, go up to them, shake their hand, thank them for what they're doing, because by doing that, you are helping enhance national security. And if they're with one of their young children, look up to that young man and say, hey, your dad is a hero. You should be proud of him. So thank you very much.
Well, thank you, Captain Chaby. Much appreciated. And thanks so much for taking the time for the weekly Yap. And I can't wait. I can't wait where we can get to share the stage together again soon.
I look forward to it as well, Travis. Have a great day. Have a great weekend.